Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
I'm going to ask you to remain here. If not, I'm going to ask you to go ahead and leave the building.
Black Lives Matter protesters at a community meeting Mayor Eric Garcetti held last night at the Holman United Methodist Church in South L.A. The meeting was meant to help improve the mayor's relationship with the community there, but protesters constantly interrupted him and disrupted the meeting. Finally, the mayor was forced to leave. His security detail had to push through a throng of protesters outside the church to get him to his car. Well, joining me now is Mayor Garcetti. Welcome to the program.
How you doing, Madeline?
I'm great. Well, how did you feel last night when you had to leave and you were forced to stop speaking?
Well, a couple things. One, I wasn't forced to leave. We had a meeting that was going to be from 7 to 8, and I stayed even longer, and I stayed on the stage until the Pastor Sauls at Holman United Methodist, said that the meeting was over. And I even offered to stay longer. People didn't have to push me through a throng. I walked calmly to my car. And, you know, I think this was not also just one other thing about improving a relationship between a mayor and one group of people. This was about delivering services and addressing important issues in our community, which I'm proud to do as mayor and proud to continue to be able to do, whether it's our housing crisis, whether it's looking at homelessness, whether it's jobs in South LA and for African Americans or incarceration crisis. About 300 people showed up. And I, as I said, you know, part of being mayor, some people are going to shout. I'm used to that. Some people are going to shout over others. And a lot of people left because they couldn't hear anything anymore. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to continue doing the work, which is really what fuels me. And I know which is what the passion behind everybody who was there, whether they were shouting or listening, was
right.
About.
Okay, so some people turned their backs to you as you were speaking. Other people, as we heard, shouted you down and interrupted you, and that did happen. And you know, this was described in the paper today, the LA Times, as a form to improve your fraught relationship with the Black communities of South LA. Do you agree with that description, that you have a difficult relationship or a fraught relationship?
No, not at all. I fundamentally disagree with that. I think that, you know, there's a number of things that are very important that are facing this country. But whether it's the issues that we see coming out of Ferguson and other places about policing, I'm proud that Los Angeles was the first and will be the first large city in America to have body cameras on all of our police officers. That for the first time since Tom Bradley, I have specialists working on helping people coming out of jail and prison get jobs, that have more than doubled the number of youth summer jobs that disproportionately are going to folks who live in South LA and other folks. I have very strong support across all communities, but this isn't about me. I don't want to personalize this, and anybody who personalizes this, we lose sight of what this work is about, that this city is facing a housing crisis, a homelessness crisis, all things that we're stepping up and making progress on. To me, that's what the work of being mayor is. I love it, and every day I can make a difference doing that. I'll continue showing up, and I'll never let any shouting get me down.
All right. Well, let's talk about their anger and what they are saying. I mean, they were saying that you should fire Chief Beck. They're angry that you left before a police commission meeting to determine whether or not the officers involved in the shooting of Ezell Ford should have used deadly force or not to attend a fundraiser in Washington, D.C. And they think that you just haven't shown up to address their concerns adequately, and that is why they're angry.
Look, I respect that a group says that, but I spend a tremendous amount of time in South L.A. and have built and expanded, I think, more programs in South Los Angeles and throughout the city. We've seen a long time, for instance, our gang reduction and youth development programs, our summer night lights program. These are intervention and prevention programs that cut crime and save lives by as much as 40% per park that we put this in. Again, just to correct the record, I was here for the police commission hearing when the Ezell Ford case was decided. I was in town for that entire day, stayed, and was there for the rest of the week as well. So, you know, I think it's very important for us not to get caught up on one or two individual kind of perspectives. To me, it's looking at what's our unemployment rate? What is our homelessness level? What are we doing in terms of our incarceration? How are we going to be a city that actually addresses those things? And I think that, you know, as soon as you leave Los Angeles, for instance, the White House points to the work that we're doing here in LA as the cutting edge for 21st century policing. But we're not a perfect city, but we're certainly far ahead with independent investigations, with a civilian-led police commission, with body cameras, and with some of the model intervention work to end the cycle of violence. I'm not concerned about whether people yell at me. I'm concerned about whether young people can graduate. I'm not concerned with whether somebody disagrees with me respectfully of what my calendar is like, but whether or not we have jobs for people who are getting out of prison or our veterans who are on our streets. And that's what the focus I'll continue to keep. And mm-hmm. I'm very proud to have very, very strong support, not just the support, but also have great leaders. Phil Washington, African-American leader of Metro, the first in its history, who I recruited from Denver, was there last night. He had a lot of things to say about the Crenshaw line and a $2.2 billion investment in South LA that's providing jobs for folks and helping small businesses. Fortunately, he didn't get a lot of time to be able to speak about that. You know, we have somebody who's running the airport now, who's one of the best in the country, Deborah Ali Flint, largest airport now in the world in terms of traffic. People get on and off there, producing right. $10 billion of jobs. These are the things that I think really move a community forward and a city forward, and I'll continue doing that.
Right. But there is a lot of anger and a lot of sadness and frustration over police-involved violence and shootings. There have been 18 people this year killed by police in Los Angeles, and I believe that's the highest number of any city in the country. So what do you think needs to happen for that not to continue to happen?
And I have that same sadness. One of the things I said last night is every life in this city is holy. I don't care whether a shooting is justified or unjustified, whether it's in policy or not. It's a failure of all of us if somebody winds up dead on our streets, and we have to do everything we can. Immediately when I saw some of that this past year, well, we had the most extensive training of every single patrol officer in LAPD, operations officer, on preservation of life training, not just an hour one day, but full day and ongoing training that will be on de-escalation tactics, on saying, how do we use less force? And of course, we have an inspector general who investigates every one of these cases and said they often decide we've sent police officers to jail this year because of excessive use of force. So we have to make sure that we continue to make that system work, strengthen the training, look at ways that we can get, you know, beanbag guns and tasers instead of guns to de-escalate violent people so they don't get shot and potentially they can be taken into custody in a more peaceful way. And I take those things very seriously because any loss of life, to me, that's the worst part of the job, whether it's somebody killed in a murder on the street or whether it's at the hands of a police officer. Sometimes that's the consequence of a violent city, and police officers do heroic work, but they need to be held accountable just like everybody else.
All right. When is your next meeting in South L.A.?
I have a meeting in South L.A. all the time. I just came from one right now. I guess like the next morning I had one. We had a huge groundbreaking at Santa Barbara Plaza for Kaiser Permanente, building a medical facility that we've worked on many, many years. We had great community activists who I've worked side by side with there. I'm probably in South L.A. 3 to 4 times a week at meetings, continue to do that. This wasn't my first. That was erroneously reported. I've been doing that consistently, and I'm very proud of the work that we're doing. Invite people to join us in that work, too, because there's room for everybody in the town.
All right. Mayor Eric Garcetti, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline.
One of the people who organized the Black Lives Matter protesters last night is Malina Abdullah. She's also a professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Also at the meeting last night, Dallas Fowler, a South LA community member. She also sits on the city's police permit review panel, which is appointed by the mayor. Dallas, welcome to you.
Greetings, and thank you, Madeline, for having me.
My pleasure. Well, Malina, let's start with you. You helped organize the protesters last night, and what did you want to get out of that meeting?
So let me just be real clear. I not only helped to organize the folks who wound up protesting last night, we didn't intend for it to be a protest, but I helped to organize the meeting. There was a group of us that agreed to particular ground rules for the meeting, and I was in the meeting that actually called for a South Los Angeles town hall. So the mayor was responding to a July request made by Black Lives Matter, and that delegation included myself, and that's what the meeting was convened based on. That said, this was not the meeting that we agreed to. He did not adhere to the structure or format or drive that we had intended with the meeting, and so folks who were expecting something different wound up protesting.
What did they expect?
So what we agreed to in July was a community-driven town hall with an agenda that's defined by the community. That meant that the mayor likes to say that we should hear as well as listen. That meant that that happens on both sides, so that he's not simply there to give a campaign speech and to talk about, you know, his agenda, including body cams and spending on LAPD as a very ineffective measure to reduce crime, but to also hear what it is the community wants. And so what we agreed to was equal time and equal space and a community-defined agenda. Now, he attempted to go around that process that he agreed to in July by not inviting us to our own meeting, but we found out about the meeting and attempted to correct it in conversation with Pastor Stalls and other leaders who were helping to work on the mayor's behalf to convene this meeting. And we, again, reformatted the meeting and said that there would be equal time and equal space to community experts as well as the mayor's folks. Mm-hmm. That was, again, violated, and there were seats on stage only for the mayor and his staff. Everyone else was relegated to the pews, and we were told that we needed to only ask questions and to think about brevity rather than engaging in true dialogue, a dialogue which should have taken a total of 36 minutes and allowed for full participation by the audience, but was filibustered by the mayor and his appointees.
All right. And Dallas, let me turn to you. You were there last night. And what were you hoping to get from this meeting? And what was your reaction to how it unfolded?
Well, I just want to preface my comments with, while I have been appointed by the mayor to commissions, I am fully independent. I am not paid by any of those commissions or the mayor or the city of Los Angeles. And so I just want to be very clear on that. And okay. I have worked a number of hours and days on issues impacting women and girls in the city of Los Angeles, as well as access to opportunities for contractors here in the community. And what I came to the community meeting last night looking for questions, answers, and solutions, and a constructive dialogue. And that was not allowed to take place, and that was disappointing for me.
And do you blame the protesters, or do you blame the mayor, or both, or what?
No, I definitely blame the protesters, because we still could have had, whether or not it was going the exact way they had anticipated, we still had an opportunity for constructive dialogue, and that was missed, and it disturbed the rest of the community. And I also have to say that I grew up here in South L.A. I've watched friends in high school be killed by the police live on television, okay? I've had pain. I've lost friends to suicide based on issues that they have been crushed by a systematic program that has not supported people of color. So I have pain as well, and I sympathize, and I am not trying to downplay the pain that those young people have, and I think it's very real. But if you do not give way for a constructive dialogue, listening, answering, responding, and being respectful, it does not give it does the community a disservice, and it does yourselves a disservice. And I'll just stop at that point.
All right. And Melina, I'd like you to respond to that. You know, the point was to have a dialogue and to get a conversation going with the mayor, and that didn't seem to happen in the end. Do you regret at all that it devolved into shouting and protesting?
No, I absolutely don't regret what it turned into. I think that the community demonstrated that we won't be disrespected and disregarded. And I think that it's important that we not categorize folks as protesters. No one came in with the intention of protesting. None of us are professional protesters. Many of us are mothers. We're, you know, workers. And we came to engage in dialogue. Unfortunately, because the mayor violated agreements and didn't allow for dialogue, more than half the room, and that needs to be also stated clearly, there were over 100 folks who wound up engaging in the protest that was not planned, but is what wound up happening, right? That it's important that we understand that they, that we, are members of the community. I live literally three or four blocks from Holman. And so that is my community. And that's all of our community. Everyone who was there was basically there because we care about our communities, and we care about it not just as political appointees or political or elected officials, but we care about our community because what we're facing is a matter of life and death. When we think about LAPD being the most murderous police force in the entire nation, we are fearful for our children. When we think about the rate of black homelessness in this city, we are fearful for our families and for our loved ones, and we want something better for our community. So no one wants to protest. No one wants to raise their voice. Everyone would love to engage in dialogue that sincerely and authentically and meaningfully moves the community forward. However, when folks refuse to do that and see this as a political opportunity, an opportunity to make a stump speech in preparation for a re-election campaign, then the community sees through it.
So it sounds like you don't believe him when he says that he does care about these issues and that he's in South LA several times a week and that these are issues that concern him. It sounds like you think he's just campaigning.
I've lived in South Los Angeles for decades, and he has been the most absent mayor that I have ever seen in my entire life. And I am very politically connected, and I attend many, many political events. So I'm not just an organizer with Black Lives Matter. I'm a mother. I'm a soccer mama. You know, I'm a member of, you know, I work in my children's schools in South Los Angeles. I do work with other community organizations, including one that Dallas Fowler has gone through, the Los Angeles African American Women's Public Policy Institute. So I've been in touch with many, many elected officials and several mayors, and this has been the most absent mayor I've ever seen.
Dallas, do you agree with that or not?
I respectfully, wholeheartedly disagree with that. And I have to say that I have never seen a mayor go through and have a back to basics series of town halls where he went on a listening tour when he first came into office. That went through all of the communities of the city of Los Angeles, including South Los Angeles. He also had a budget town hall here in South Los Angeles. This was not his first town hall here today, and he has had a series of community walks with the council members in South L.A. He has done a number of things here in South L.A., and the community did not get to hear about those things last night because of a few people. And I also disagree with the amount of people. There was nowhere near 100 people that protested last night. There was, I would say, no more than 25 to 35 individuals. So that's just not true.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there because, unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank both of my guests, Dallas Fowler and Melina Abdullah. Thank you both very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having
Thank
me.
Thank you, Madeline.
All right, we want to hear from you. What did you think about what you just heard from the mayor and Melina and Dallas about the meeting last night? What would you like to hear from the mayor about issues affecting South LA? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can reach out on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. While Mayor Garcetti was being shouted down by protesters, a quieter public meeting was taking place a couple of miles away. The LA Unified School District held a forum to get the public's input on who should be the next superintendent. About 20 people showed up to the Roy Ball Learning Center just west of downtown. Howard Bloom was there. He's education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hi there.
Hi.
So just 20 people, really?
Well, two dozen, and that's not counting several reporters, the translators, and the consultants. So, you know, there might have been 40 people in the room, but as far as participants, about two dozen.
So what was the point of this?
They want to take input on the qualities needed in the next superintendent. So among the things we learned last night is that the superintendent should be fair, open-minded, should choose good principals, should be present in the schools, should have the human touch, and be God-fearing.
Wait, what was that last one?
Oh, God-fearing. That, well, and that was a very heartfelt comment, because it was attached to the idea that with all the problems facing LA Unified, being God-fearing would be helpful because you might need God's help but to solve them all.
Okay, so was this a free-for-all? People could just get up and say what they wanted and...
Yes, although they were very tentative at first, it was a very large room. It was the multi-purpose room / auditorium at a high school, very large room. It could have held hundreds of people, and it was a very small crowd, so the consultants gathered them together in a small area, and he really had to encourage people to get going. But after a while, they spoke in English and Spanish, translations were provided, and people said what their opinions were, and the one consultant was leading the meeting, two others were getting it all down.
So what do you think the district learned besides the fact that they should probably do more outreach publicizing these meetings going forward?
I don't know what they learned. I mean, they've got more than 100 of these meetings scheduled of various sorts now. About 25 of them are meetings like this. They're listed on the district website. They're noted as community meetings. There are also other sorts of meetings that involve union leaders, principals, staff, psychologists, civic groups. The mayor will have a meeting probably. Some of these meetings will be public. Some of these will be private. The consultants get it all down. Then they write a report that I guess can't be too thick because one must read it. And then they present this to the board and say, here's your leadership profile.
And then they have to go out and find someone who fits that profile.
Yes. Now, you're assuming that they're not starting to do that already, and I would think that they're already gathering candidates. But, yes, among the candidates that they're gathering, they hope to find one person who fits that leadership profile. But, I mean, when you sum up all this input into a leadership profile, which is what, a paragraph or something, there's a lot of artistry in that, shall we say.
Right. And it sounds a bit like they're looking for a unicorn.
Well, yes, a very talented unicorn, to be sure. And, I mean, this is a very hard job. When Roy Romer, the three-term governor of Colorado, came to be superintendent, he said it was the hardest job he ever had in his life, even harder than being the head of the Democratic National Convention. And it's probably only gotten harder in the years since. So, yeah, it's a really hard job. And we have lots of advice on the kind of person we'll need, a cross between a saint and a clever political sinner, I guess.
Okay, so meanwhile, Ray Cortinas has talked about retiring in a couple of months from now.
He would like to leave by the end of the year. I don't know if that's a hard and fast deadline, but that is the deadline people are saying. They're trying to complete the superintendent search by the end of the year. And by the way, with all this input, the search itself is being conducted confidentially. So if they can keep their confidences, we will not know who the choice is until that choice is presented.
So what do you think about taking all this information in from all these hundreds of meetings that you described and the public meetings and the reports and all that? Is it all really necessary? And are they going to use this information really, or are they just going to find someone that they like and pick that person?
Well, you know what? Their job is to pick the best person for the job. That's in fact, it's the main thing that the school board does above all else, is pick the superintendent to run the district and then make sure that the superintendent is doing the job. And you can't sublet that out to people of various opinions, especially when you're getting every opinion out there in one form or another. It's ultimately your responsibility. Now, will this make people feel as though they had a role in choosing the leader? Maybe. Will it make more people more consistently involved in schools because of this? Well, that would be okay if it did that. But it does seem that the push for community involvement is something that should happen every day.
All right. And I understand there are meetings scheduled for as early as tonight. More meetings.
More meetings. More than 100 between now and the end of October. So get your calendar filled. You can definitely get your say in on who the next superintendent should be and whether they should be fair-minded or God-fearing first.
Okay. And I think you can do that at achieve.lausd.net/next-superintendent. Howard Bloom, education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks.
Sure.
Coming up, the federal government subsidizes women who breastfeed, but what if breast isn't best? That story is next on Press Play.
Mm-hmm. Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It is the debate that will not die, to breastfeed or not to breastfeed. And that debate is increasingly playing out in public, both in public forums like the New York Times over the weekend, and when it comes to public support from mothers with small children. Government subsidies are offered to entice poor women to breastfeed. In fact, women who breastfeed get more nutritious food from the WIC program than women who use infant formula. Joining us now is Gail Semick-Lamond. She wrote about the breastfeeding debate for The Atlantic. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, you typically write about national security and foreign policy issues, right? Why did you write about this?
You know, that piece, I was just motivated to write because I was a new mom at the time, and I was listening to so many friends of mine really berate themselves and be berated by others at a time when they were so vulnerable, really struggling with, you know, getting their bodies back, how to feel great about themselves, how to be good parents, how to get their lives back on a semblance of a schedule that worked for their little one and for them. And at the same time, dealing with this very public pressure to breastfeed. And for some of them, it wasn't working. And the shaming that was going on, I just could not believe I was seeing. Because, you know, to me, this was the last thing a new mother needed, was to be berated or shamed just when she was most vulnerable and really resetting her life.
Uh-huh. And so it's not just shaming, though. It's actual incentives put forth by the government. So
that's right. And this was, the Atlantic piece was a reaction to the New York City regulation that said a reason had to be given if you requested infant formula.
You had to justify the request for infant formula?
That's correct. That's what the regulation was saying at the time. And, you know, there were a lot of people that said, I am a grown-up. Why do I have to tell you what's going to work for me personally? And for me, that's what resonated with me, was that we're not supporting people to say, hey, make the choices that work for you, that work for your children, that work for your family. We're saying this is the right way. And if you don't do it, you're a bad parent. And we're going to basically shame you and into agreeing with what we say.
Right. And then there's the WIC program I mentioned earlier that rewards women for breastfeeding by actually giving their infants healthier food or food with more protein in it.
Well, and it's the thing. It's like formula is FDA approved. These are not parents who are trying to harm their infant. And to say that you get less great nutrition because you have to use formula for whatever reason that might be, whether it's women who are working, you know, 8 or 10 hours and then commuting 1 or 2 hours and can't. Or whether it's because for them it's not working physically, that to me is not a place where we should be actually castigating. I understand offering things that make it easier. I think that's great. But to say that you don't get things because you don't breastfeed when it comes to the nutrition for your infant, to me, makes no sense.
And you do get help if you want to rent a breast pumping or buy a breast pumping machine, right? It's covered under the Affordable Care Act?
Yes, and that's the thing is that, you know, and I think nobody would say that, you know, new mothers who want to breastfeed should not be assisted. Absolutely. The question is, are you penalizing other people? And are you taking your own personal values and choices and thrusting them on people and making them feel pretty awful just at a time when we should really be supporting new parents? And the whole infrastructure to support new parents really is not there in this country, right? And to focus on this one thing and use it almost as a penalty, as a stick, is to me really out of pace with a society that should be supporting its new parents at every turn.
Right, because there's no paid maternal leave in most states.
That's right.
So
that's right. And you know, even when I was a new parent, I had short-term disability at one point because I hadn't been at a job long enough. And you just think, well, gosh, I didn't have a mother who was disability, but that's the way a lot of the regulation works.
Yeah, although I can attest that you sometimes do feel like you're disabled being a new mom, at least mentally.
Definitely challenged.
Okay. Well, I guess this is all coming in reaction to the fact that infant formula was pushed quite heavily for many, many years in hospitals to new mothers, and breastfeeding was actively discouraged.
Right. And I think that, you know, the pendulum returning to the center would be a great thing. right, where we say, here are your choices. What works for you? What works for your family? What works for your baby? What works for your body? Right. But what surprised me so much about the breastfeeding thing when I was really had a lot of infants one time and I had twins, was just to listen to people say, you know, you're either a bad parent or you're a good parent. And that's determined by whether you breastfeed. And none of the other issues about how is your body able to do that? Does it work for your what you have to do to provide income for your children? Does it work for everybody else? You know, none of that was discussed. And it became really another way to shame and, you know, give a hard time to women. And oftentimes it was coming from other women, which surprised me even more.
What about the research supporting breastfeeding as a healthier option for babies?
And I think it's so interesting, right? I mean, the New York Times piece really looked at the fact that you could make an argument either way. I don't think most people would say on balance there certainly are benefits to breastfeeding, but they can be outweighed by other things. And also, not every woman is able to breastfeed in the way, you know, that will help give nutrition to that her infant needs at that time. So, you know, and I think we'll continue to see this debate play out. But in the meantime, it's playing out in women's lives at a time when they most need support, not penalization.
Gail Semek-Lamond, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on the program for us here in Los Angeles, the drought is a bit of an abstraction. Water still runs freely from our taps, but in some places in California, it doesn't.
Just when you think you've seen it all, you go to the Salton Sea and it's hundreds of thousands of dead fish that you're crunch, crunch. It's unbelievable.
Stories from the drought after a news update with Eric Roy.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We keep hearing what a big impact the drought is having in our state, but we don't really feel it here in Los Angeles. Water still comes out of the tap. People still water their lawns. In fact, here on the show, we were just talking about the unknown Bel Air resident who's using almost 12 million gallons of water in a year. Well, in tiny Fairmead, California, that's halfway between Fresno and Merced in the Central Valley, the drought is for real. One of the residents, Thelma Williams, has been without water for 5 years.
There's things you have to go through, like warm up your water on the stove before you wash your dishes and make sure you got water to flush. Make sure I got water for my cooler. There's a lot of things you have to do. You don't just get up and do your regular routine.
When did you know that that was happening? Did you get a warning?
Yeah, I opened the tab and just that was it.
Karen Fauché is a senior investigative producer at Al Jazeera. She and her team recently traveled throughout the state talking with people and reporting on local impacts of the drought. And she's here now to tell us about the experience. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. So tell me more about Thelma and this town she lives in, Fairmead.
Sure. And the fellow you heard there is Michael Oku, who is the correspondent I work with. Fairmead's a very small farming town, as you said, right between Fresno and Merced. We literally drove into the town and I pulled over and just stopped and started talking to her. I literally just saw her on the side of the road. We get to chatting and immediately she went there and said, I'm out of water. And in fact, we then asked her, well, how many other people are out of water? And she started to name, you know, half a dozen people just on her street that don't have water. She lost her water one day, as she describes. The tap just went dry. And that's because she relied on groundwater. And what happened was some new neighbors moved in.
New neighbors being almond orchards.
That's right. And if you look at her home, she is surrounded by these almond farms. And they simply got a bigger drill, went deeper, and took her water.
And there's nothing she can do about it?
No. And in fact, when we walked around her property, she pointed to her car, and it was quite a scene. She just has jugs of water in her car. I mean, giant, like Arrowhead Sparklets jugs of water.
Where does she get it?
Well, she goes to a water store, and she goes twice a day to buy water when she can. And these are heavy jugs. I don't know how she even lifts all of them. And as we found in our road trip, she's one of the lucky ones. Some people can't make it to the water store. They can't afford to be buying water twice a day. And we saw that over and over again.
So she's using the water in these jugs for showering, mm-hmm. for flushing the toilet?
Yep. She actually has a neighbor that she sometimes showers, and she was describing how, you know, it's a little uncomfortable to constantly be going over there. I need to take a shower. You know, I need to, you know, bathe. She feels terrible. But that is the life a lot of these people have in these small towns. We met a farmer in Chowchilla who used to have 60 cows. Now he's down to 4 because the water went dry, because an almond farm opened up, took all his water. He had to sell all his cattle. He doesn't know what he's going to do now.
What are state or local officials doing about this?
You know, Jerry Brown last year pledged $600 million that was to go to drought relief for a lot of these communities. But when you drive around, you don't know where that money's going. How is this impacting? Last year, he also put some rules in place on groundwater drilling. Before that, we were the only Western state that had unlimited, unregulated groundwater drilling.
But those don't go into effect for a long time.
Well, there's some sustainability plans that are supposed to be met come 2017 and 2040, but you're right. I don't know what the solution is, frankly, right here. But what I'm seeing is town after town getting destroyed. I mean, people are going without water, and they just seem to be doing a lot of waiting for something to happen.
Waiting for the rain,
waiting for help. We went to Mendota where they're trucking some water in. There's a little bit of that as well, but I don't know how long this is going to last.
You spoke with another woman. Her name is Kathy Fowler. She runs a food bank, and that's in a small town called Dos Palos. That's near Merced. And she says that, you know, a lot of these people, they can't afford to buy the water, but they can't afford to move either.
Yeah, that's right.
Nobody seems to be understanding that we are really in the middle of a very, very desperate situation. How are these people going to move? They don't have the money. Where are they going to go?
And she's talking about farm workers there?
Yeah, she took us to a farm labor camp in Mendota, which is near Dos Palos. And, you know, a lot of the folks there we talked to had their hours cut at the fields, and they don't have running
because
water.
Because of the drought.
And we saw that over... Exactly. And then they can't buy food or you know, products at the store. It has this domino effect. And they don't... And some families are, you know, if they hear about water at a melon farm over here, they move. I've heard those stories, but it's very difficult, you know. I talked to one family of 7 that relies on 2 gallons of water a day. It's all they can afford. And so it's funny about Kathy. She grew up in the Dust Bowl years. And she said this is very reminiscent of the scene she saw as a child.
In the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
In Interesting. Texas. So you also went to the Southern Sierra Mountains to look at how the drought is affecting the trees and the forests. What did you see?
Devastation. I had been to Mariposa 10 years ago. I hadn't been since. And I was stunned. It's just the colors of green and rust. It's like fall came to Mariposa, but the leaves don't change there. And it's just millions of dead trees. I was actually stunned. We drove in early, late in the night. I woke up in the morning and I opened, you know, the door and I was shocked. It's just millions of dead trees, one after another after another.
And you spoke to Rich Drozen. He's assistant chief for CAL FIRE about what's happening there.
Well, ordinarily you lose 5% of your trees a year. Right now we're looking at losing 50% of our trees in certain species. So it's a slow motion disaster.
And maybe not so slow motion when you think of the fire hazard.
Yeah, you know, that's what's really scary up there is that you've got these trees ready to go. And guess what? The ponds are dry. Rich took us on a tour. Pond after lake are dry. And these are ponds and water sources they rely on for fire. So he told us we have to now travel. It's a triple time now to respond to a fire in that area. We now have to go 3 times further to get water if a fire goes. So they are terrified. They actually took us to this viewpoint called Miami, which is 4,300 feet up. And they man it now 24/7. They are so worried about a fire. While we were there, a puff of smoke, they spotted it. And there was concern. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are really, really worried about this. And Madeline, you can't get rid of these trees. They can't go in and just tear them down because they're on private property. They are not allowed to just go and chop down trees. And guess what? It costs up to $1,200 to take a tree down. So the residents can't necessarily afford it.
Why doesn't the state come in and cut these trees down?
Well, while we were up there,
emergency.
And they are. There is some grant. PG&E actually gave some money while we were up there. There was some tree clearance, but it's small, and they would like that. The Mariposa Fire Safety Council told me they have repeatedly asked for money to take these trees down. They finally got a grant from PG&E, but it's certainly not enough.
All right. Then you drove south to the Salton Sea in the Imperial Valley, and this is quite a sight. It looks otherworldly, the Salton Sea.
Yeah, and a smelly sight. It's so, you know, we've heard about this fish die-off, and I went there, and just when you think you've seen it all, you go to the Salton Sea, and it's hundreds of thousands of dead fish that you're crunch, crunch. It's unbelievable. And you can see the die-offs, big fish, small fish, you know, yellowfish. You can see the progression. It's just heartbreaking. It is an ecological disaster. And that has been reported on. But then we had heard that there was all these cases of asthma. Mm-hmm. So we traveled a little bit further downwind to Calexico, where we had been told the rates of asthma are really bad because as the sea dies, all the toxic dust from the lake bed is blowing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ending up as airborne particles. And we literally just found a school, and there's an American flag, a California flag, and then what I call the asthma flag. And they fly flags now. Every day, to green means good, red's bad, and they use those flags to determine if the children can play outside. Everyone we knew seemed to be on a nebulizer. I've never seen so much asthma, and they just said this is the way it is now. They also mentioned, Madeline, I heard this in all 15, and we traveled 1,500 miles on this. Everyone kept saying the days are getting hotter, and there's more of them. And everybody kept saying, it's changed. It's different now.
And you spoke to an environmental reporter down there. His name is Chris Clark. He says it is getting so hot, the farm workers might not be able to work there much longer.
People that come here and work in the farms, they're used to heat. They're not afraid of working hard. They're very motivated. But there is a point at which even a motivated person just can't take a certain amount of heat. And it's going to change the way we do things here.
The Imperial Valley, this is where we get our lettuce, or a lot of our lettuce is grown in the Imperial
Valley.
That's
right. This is a significant, you know, area for growth. We're talking all the way down to Blythe, Calexico. We get alfalfa. Lettuce grows there. It's also where NASA is predicting at the end of the century that it will be so hot, so dry, parts of it may be uninhabitable. It's part of what they call the mega drought, the worst drought in 1,200 years. Now, it may not be as bad if we do something about climate change like right now, but the projections are dire for that part of the Southwest.
So no one would be able to go out there and pick the lettuces.
Yeah.
The lettuces wouldn't be able to live.
It's 130, 140 degrees. Already when we were there, it was 106, and they were telling me it was very comfortable.
Oh, wow.
I swear.
Well, we do know how to adapt as humans. Well, you think that this is such a huge industry, a multi-billion dollar industry, that the people at the top would be trying to do something about this.
Yeah, and they are. I mean, there's certainly conversations happening with that. And Jerry Brown signed legislation to save the Salton Sea. He seems to be proactive, finally, after years of people wanting some help. But, you know, a lot of this, the Imperial Valley is a good example in the Salton Sea. Salton Sea, some would say, is a victim of the water wars because we've played these games where we've diverted water. Water's not going to the Salton Sea after 2017 because it's going to the coastal cities in San Diego. So all these deals were made. And, I've wondered about this. When will we start discussing water rights? You know, it's always been a taboo. Let's not do that here in California. But you wonder if we're getting to that point now when we hear about senior water rights and junior water rights and what we're growing and almonds. And you wonder, maybe now is the time to be really having those conversations about what the priorities are.
Well, it's also so interesting that when you think of the Owens River Valley and what we had to do there with the dust mitigation, we're still doing that. We're sending our water up there to tamp down the dust from taking that water a century ago to build Los Angeles.
Yeah. And so would say that's what we're going to have at the Salton Sea. Jerry Brown did appoint Bruce Wilcox, who we interviewed for this story, the first person appointed to really as part of a task force to save the Salton Sea. The projections are this toxic dust could come as far as way as Los Angeles if something is not done about it.
All right. Well, we keep hearing El Nino is on the way. It's going to dump record amounts of rainfall, not only here in Southern California, but also in Northern California. So is that something that could go a long way to, you know, ameliorating the situation?
Yeah. I mean, we heard a lot about that. We hope El Nino comes, and sure, that's welcomed. But, you know, there is a downside to that. There are serious concerns of floods, you know, in these areas, especially in the Central Valley. We've seen that before. And Madeline, here's a scary thought. There is a report out in Science Magazine that discusses there is concern that the drought has compromised some of the 13,000 miles of levees in California because the land is sinking. And the concern is that it has compromised the foundation of those levees. So when El Nino comes, will those levees do their jobs? I have to tell you, when we were in Chowchilla, I did see a photo of a bridge where the poles, some of the poles have come, they're not attached to the bridge anymore.
The land sinking?
Because the land is
because of
to
all
sink.
The drilling for water.
Correct. So we'll see. We all hope. It also comes with some negatives, some real concerns.
Well, Karen, thank you for coming in and scaring the bejesus out of all of us.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Karen Fauché, senior producer at Al Jazeera. And to see her story with some really stunning images, go to aljazeera.net and type in the name of her show, America Tonight. Coming up, you go to IKEA for hard-to-pronounce furniture, but it's also a restaurant. How IKEA became a food destination. That's next on Press Play.
KCRW's popular iPad Music Mine app is now available for the iPhone. From quick discovery to deep exploration, take KCRW Music with you wherever you go. Download at kcrw.com/musicmine.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. IKEA, you know it for its DIY furniture, its massive stores, its reputation as a relationship killer. But what about the meatballs? IKEA's in-store restaurants and markets are a strange mix of Scandinavian products and regular American junk food. So along with hot dogs, pizza, and soft serve, you'll find fish paste, muesli, and yeah, Swedish meatballs. It turns out this strange menu is a huge piece of IKEA's business. IKEA food even has its own cult following. Catherine Spires is a food writer in LA. She's been digging into the culinary side of IKEA, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi there.
Or how would you say that in Swedish?
Oh, gosh.
Something like Vilkomen or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so most of our listeners have been to an IKEA and
absolutely
probably have wandered down to the bowels at the end of a massive shopping spree and thought, I'm so hungry, I'm so thirsty.
Yes. And that is what they are banking on. They make a lot of money off of the food that they offer there. But it's sort of funny. They have a couple different categories. They have Swedish food in every single location. That's very important to them.
For the identity, the brand identity.
Yeah, the IKEA identity. Uh-huh. You will find salmon, some sort of salmon, in every IKEA all over the world. But then that's the sit-down restaurant. And then there's also the sort of market at the area where you can buy packaged food and you can also buy things like hot dogs. Hot dogs and a drink for $2.
Which is American.
Yes.
And not Swedish.
Right. That's a pretty American innovation. Right. It's interesting, though. IKEA is really picking up on the fact that people are into their food. So much of their social media revolves around, like, their food hacks, weird things to do with the meatballs, and they have food contests. And if you're a member of what they call the IKEA family, which is their rewards program, a lot of the rewards are about, like, come in and you'll get $2 off waffles this week or something like that.
So do people prefer the Swedish or the American food?
Well, I think that the Swedish food is more of a interesting treat for people, although they can't take it too far. They did try and sell lutefisk, and apparently the only store outside of Scandinavian that works in is the Seattle store, because there's a lot of people of Scandinavian descent there. Otherwise, it's just baked salmon.
What is that?
That's fish that has been cured under... It's rotten fish, but it's a big delicacy in Scandinavia. Yeah, so that one doesn't go over so well in other countries.
Well, so this must be big business for IKEA.
Yeah, it's dollars-wise, it's a big part of it. So total sales worldwide for IKEA is 28.7 billion euros every year. Food sales are only 1.46 billion, but it's growing all the time, and especially as they're focusing more on the restaurants, and they're actually growing in countries that also want the food. In France at IKEA, you can get steak au poivre. And in Thailand IKEA, you can get spring rolls and you can get vinegar marinated chicken wings. And in Japan, you can get udon. So they do local specialties.
We are being
well.
Cheated here.
You know, I kind of agree.
Really?
I mean, the menu items here don't seem all that exciting. But you can get barbecued ribs with cornbread now. That's one of the things okay. that they're offering that they're trying out at the Burbank location. And it's only going to get even bigger. The current Burbank IKEA. It is the biggest IKEA in the Western United States, but the new one that they're opening is going to be twice as big as the current one. The current one has...
It's still in Burbank.
Yeah, it'll still be in Burbank. The current location has seating for 200 in the restaurant. The new location will have seating for 600. So they're definitely banking on people coming out there to eat.
Maybe just to eat?
Not everyone needs to buy lamps every day, but people do need to eat every day. They also do special programs like what they call the crayfish. Most Americans, I think, call it crawfish. Mm-hmm. But they have a crayfish feast every fall. And you can buy boxes of brined crayfish in the market. That market is the funniest selection.
They're just not going to give up on their fish.
No, they're not. I was looking in the freezer section, and next to these boxes of crayfish, they also have whole hams.
Why not? It's IKEA.
Exactly. Throw a whole ham in there, too.
And a little L wrench or whatever to put it together.
Yeah, it all makes sense. You can get like tubes of salmon paste, if that's what
you're
into.
What do you do with that?
Oh, you know, put it on some toast, maybe. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's just kind of like a mousse, and it comes in a tube like a toothpaste.
You're making it sound so appetizing.
I'm not here to sell it for him. It's just it is what it is. Buy it if you want.
But is there a food that you really like?
I think that the meatballs are like perfect comfort food.
And the soft serve?
I don't know that it's any different from any other, but of course it's a delicious treat.
Soft serve.
Yeah.
Catherine Spires, food writer in LA. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for us today. If you want to comment on anything you heard on the show, we're getting lots and lots of comments on our first segment of the day, and that was about Mayor Eric Garcetti and the meeting in South LA last night. Facebook, KCRW Press Play, Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney and To The Point is up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a fantastic afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.